First of all, were you drafted or did you enlist for World War I?
I was conscripted.
How did you feel about that?
How did I feel about it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, before I was conscripted, when I knew we were going to have the war, when we signed up in the with the draft boards, you know, then I went to enlist in the Navy and they wouldn't have us, so they had enough in the Navy. So then I said I will wait for the draft and I would like to go along with the first contingent. Then they forgot that, so I went with the second one, which meant me 2 weeks later.
What was your training experience at Camp Custer like?
Well, my experience was not too bad because I had trained 3 years in the National Guard, the Michigan National Guard. And when the captain found that out, I immediately became sergeant, so I was a little bit ahead of many of the others.
And were you happy then about being sent over to the overseas and to France at that time?
Well, I don't think anybody could say that. Well, I guess some guys were, but I wouldn't say I was happy. I was willing. I wasn't. Well, you might have a moment of, well, ill at ease or something too, going away. I had 6 sisters and 2 brothers and mother and father behind. I was the only one out of the whole gang in the service.
Okay. What did you think your orders would be after you finished training at Camp Custer?
Well, when we got the orders to leave, all we knew, we were going to board ships and go to England, and we landed at Liverpool. And then we were moved over to Camp Cowshot. It was over near London, about 25 miles from London. Camp Cowshot was at a town called Brookwood. And we were there for, I think nearly 4 weeks. And then one evening, they sent us up to Newcastle on the Tyne by rail. And the next night we left there at midnight. It happened to be a nice dark night. So we sailed out on the, I was on a boat called Nagoya. Sailed down the river and the first thing we knew when it got daylight, we got farther going north, we could tell that. Then they put the infantrymen out on the boat. We were on iceberg guard duty, looking for iceberg because we were seeing them going up along the Norwegian coast. And when we got up to the Arctic Ocean, too.
So
we were 2 weeks doing that to get from Newcastle to Archangel.
When did you find out that you would be going to Archangel?
Well, we, honest to goodness, we didn't even know when we were on a boat, but it didn't take much sense to know we were going someplace like that. When you find icebergs and you're going up in the Arctic Circle,
They don't
tell the enlisted men what they're doing. The officers have that, and they have to come pass on the word from one to the other and so forth.
So when you were in England, you still thought you would be going to France?
No, because they issued us some heavy underwear. That kind of threw us off too, you know. In August, you didn't need any heavy underwear in France. But by September, you needed all right in the Archangel or Russia. I never spent any time in Archangel.
Okay. What did you know of Russia when you landed there? Did you know anything about it or about Bolshevism or anything like that?
Oh, we knew there was some Bolshevik going on because we came there just about the time of the revolution.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that these guys were there trying to agitate the revolution. And I think we did more in the revolution than we did in anything else.
How did you feel about Bolshevism?
Well, I still don't like it.
Yeah, we're against it then too. Okay. On the trip across on the Nagoya, what kind of medical care were there for the soldiers who had the Spanish flu?
Well, we had on the ship I was on. We just had some men who were like in the medical corps. And they would dish out some pills, this or that or the other thing. And on the boat I was on, actually no one died, but we could see there was also some Italian boats following along with us. And we could see those guys going overboard every once in a while. They died, you know, they couldn't keep them. They had to bury them at sea. And they were fellows that they took from southern Italy. foolish thing to do too. Well, they could have been maybe a little better off. They take some for the northern part instead of the sunny part.
Mm. So would you say that the medical care was adequate then on the boat?
No, no, I wouldn't say it was adequate. I don't know if it was ever adequate. Best to my knowledge, we only had two doctors out on the field with us.
Did they have enough medicine to get to people who needed it?
The best medicine we had was the rum we stole from the British.
Everybody seemed to do that. Okay, I think,
what were your first instructions after you arrived, Dr.
After
Archangel?
After we unloaded in Russia?
Yeah, as soon as you got to Russia.
We got off the boat at a place called Brezny, and that's right across the bay from Archangel. Our boat didn't stop at Archangel at all.
Oh.
The next day we were loaded on some scows, and then we started going up the Dvina River. Now this is my unit that did this, the first battalion. The
mm-hmm.
second battalion, they, I think, went down the railroad, so that would be a little different story. I never did get to the railroad.
How much did you know about what you were going off to do? You got on these boats with all the company members.
Well, while we were still on the boat, the rumor was we're going to Russia to preserve the rations that were there. But
mm-hmm.
there were no rations there when we got there. People were very hungry. As a matter of fact, they ate the garbage that we threw off of the boat. Of course, we brought a lot of rations along with us, and then boats kept coming in. They had to get it in it because the place would freeze up solid before winter came, you know.
When were you first informed that you would be fighting the Bolsheviks?
I don't think we were ever informed that we were fighting the Bolsheviks. There was another, as far as we're concerned, I guess maybe it was true, but to us it was a rumor. We were going there to guard the rations and prevent the Germans from establishing a submarine base in the White Sea. Now, could they have done that and the war continued, that would have been a good advantage point for them for the North Atlantic. But that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
The revolution came there before that happened. The war started before they could have ever done much about it anyway.
Who commanded your outfit or your company?
Colonel Craig, Lieutenant Colonel Craig, was promoted to Colonel when we got to Russia.
Do you recollect anything about him? Did you work under him?
Not very much. Didn't see him very often. We'd see a major more than we'd see a colonel. And Corbett was the major of our battalion.
Did you ever see General Poole?
Yeah. No, not Poole. Ironside.
Okay. Ironside?
Yeah.
What do you remember about Ironside?
Well, he came up to visit us. We were holding a base up the river a ways there, and he came up. He was going to have an inspection, I guess. And as soon as he got there, the Bolsheviks started cannon fire, you know, artillery fire. So he just hustled right back again. He wasn't there half a day.
What about Stuart? Colonel Stuart?
He was the American.
That's the
in
guy.
Charge
that,
of
I was mistaken when I said Craig was our colonel when we were in Camp Custer. He didn't go to Russia with us. Stuart went with us.
And he's the one you never saw?
Not very often, no. We'd see our major every once in a while. But there, the majors are the ones that conduct the war from the headquarters, you know. They get orders from the headquarters where we're supposed to go and things like that.
What do you remember about Major Corbin?
Very good soldier. Probably the best major we had up there.
What was the rank of the man generally in charge of your detachment? You said that you were divided up and scattered all around.
Well, a lieutenant would be in charge of it. Sometimes it might be a first lieutenant or it might be a second lieutenant. In my case, it was a second lieutenant. Smith's platoon was also a second lieutenant. Now the first and fourth platoons, they had first lieutenants.
Were you ever in charge of a group of men who were sent on?
Oh yeah, you have details.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a corporal can take a detail, sometimes a sergeant does. But we got down to where we only had two sergeants, so this should be four, but we, through sickness and things, they didn't have any replacements there. Hard job to get them. We did get some replacements from France, from another unit that was trained at Camp Custer, went overseas same time we did. But they went to France and we went to Russia.
When did they join you?
Beg pardon?
When did they join you? When did they meet you in Russia? When did they come over to Russia?
Oh, just before the thing froze up tight. They were shipped from France up to be replacements. Of course, we, you know, we had a lot of guys who were sick, and a lot of them died from just from sickness. Never, never heard a bullet even.
When did you first encounter the Bolsheviks, and where?
Well, as I was saying, we loaded on this scow in a tug that burned slabs to make steam with, wood burning. And they hauled us, I think, about 75 miles, which took a couple of days. And then we got off and we started tramping along the river and roads that lead along the river looking for the Bolsheviks. And in a couple more days, we met up with them. But at that particular time, like I've always said, 50 Americans could chase 500 of those at that particular time. But before it was over, it was reversed.
So they didn't give you the impression of being well trained then?
No, not in the beginning. We had the ragtag of the White Army and the Red Army. The White was supposed to be on our side. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be helping them. And the Red were the Communists or the Bolsheviks, Bolas, we knew them as.
Were their weapons and numbers far superior to yours?
We used the same rifle, same ammunition. We trained in Camp Custer with an Enfield, and when we got there we used the same Russian rifle. That was because we figured we would, you know, capture their ammunition, and we would have the ammunition there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good gun. It was a little longer than the one we trained with over in Custer. And they had a three-cornered bayonet where we used them a flat bayonet.
You said before that when you got out off of the scows, you started walking to find the Bolsheviks. So what were you told then? That you were supposed to go out and fight the Bolsheviks now?
Sure.
Was that the first time that you knew you were going to fight the Bolsheviks?
Well, like you have to remember the Russians made a separate peace with Germany. And so as things progressed, they didn't need anybody on the Eastern Front anymore because there was no fighting going on there. So those people who had been on the Eastern Front, that made it tough for us later on. They were trained soldiers, where at first we were just had these ragtag, I call them.
Were you told why you were supposed to fight the Bolsheviks?
No, they don't tell you those things. You're sent out there and the enemy is there, so you do the best you can with them.
So where did you go when you got off the Dvina River and you started walking
to fight? We went on up the Dvina River where the biggest fight we had was at Tolgas. Upper and lower Tolgas, and we held that for about a week. And then there were two or three platoons sent out ahead just to reconnoiter and see if we could see anything out there. And I took one patrol out myself. And we were told to follow a river that was a tributary of the Dvina River. And so it weaves like this, you know. We were 8 hours going out, took us about an hour and a half to come back because we cut right straight back there.
Was that the Vega River?
Dvina River. The Vaga River,
Vaga?
No, this was some other smaller tributary.
Oh.
The Vaga River was farther north than we were then. We were going south all the time.
Okay, before you fought at Tolgas, were you at there was a battle at Seltso. Really soon after.
Seltso and Tolgas were all along the river.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those towns, as you came along, we had to chase them out. Then sometimes they would skip maybe two or three towns and we just have to keep following on to find out where they are again.
When did your advance stop? When you and you kept going south. And when did you stop advancing south?
Well, we were that far up, and then they put us on a scow, and we came back and went up the Vaga River far ways.
Oh.
And I think in that area is where the Kodesh front was. But we didn't get to Kodesh. We stopped before that. We were at a town called Vertnikitsa, Vistavka, along that river.
We went
further south. We were, this officer that I was with, under the command of a Russian captain, one platoon, third or fourth platoon, third platoon, went. We had 40 men left then, and he had about 40, and we were like freelancers. We went wherever this guy wanted to go. And he really knew his stuff, and he had men with him that knew how to find their way around in the woods. Tremendous fellow. Captain Michevsky. He was a Russian, and he had been an officer in the Tsar's army.
Oh.
So he was a white Russian.
When did you find out that the armistice had been signed?
Oh, I think it was near Christmas or New Year's or something like that.
What impact?
Yeah, we certainly didn't know it on that day.
Do you remember what you were doing on that day?
No.
No?
It had no significance to us. No, where we lived was just another day.
What impact did the news of the armistice have on the troops?
Well, we wondered why we have to keep on staying there. You know, our hardest fighting was after, in 1919, and the armistice was at, what, in November 11th?
Mm-hmm.
In 18, and after the armistice, we had harder going than we had in the beginning when we first started out there. We lost more casualties and harder fighting.
So, would you say that the morale was lowered after the men found out that the war in the West was over?
Well, there was a different kind of morale. And then you knew you were fighting for self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, as far as fighting them, that didn't mean anything to us. We wanted to stay alive and get the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And many of us didn't.
How far did the wounded have to be transported? About, did they have to go a long ways when they were wounded at the front? Across
the wounded, they had a hospital in Archangel.
Uh-huh.
So the wounded were finally, by sled. There was no other way, no other mode of travel except with one of these little horses and a sled, which the Russians had quite a few of those. And they even hauled some of our equipment for us. And so it'd be a ride on a sled if he was, you know, wounded bad enough to have to go to hospital. It was a ride from there to Archangel, depending on where you were. At one time, I was 300 miles from Archangel.
And there was nothing between where you were and Archangel?
Just a line of communication, which was very thin.
Mm-hmm. And
nearly always, when they attacked us, nearly always they attacked from the rear. I remember one morning up there at Tolgus, this was the second attack on us, the Canadian artillery was there with us, and they had their guns facing, you know, where the enemy should be, but they had circled around and came in the back. So these Canadians, they pulled their guns out of the pit and reversed them and gave a muzzle burst. And they killed an awful lot of Russians that day.
Do you remember where that was at?
That was at Tolgus.
Oh,
Tolgus was sort of a focal point. There was some stories about it. We were going south and there was another army should start at the Vladivostok and they would come north and we would meet somewhere along the line. And then we could combine our forces. But nothing like that ever happened. As far as I know, it never came close.
You were saying before that there were only a couple of doctors for each company, was it?
I don't think there were a couple of doctors for each company.
Uh-huh.
There was a medical corps there,
uh-huh,
which was in charge of one doctor. and they would have the hospital corps. These men were like the infantry men, only they worked in the hospital department. Then there was an ambulance, the 337th ambulance and the 337th hospital.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of medical care was there right when a person would get wounded, right at the front? What kind of care was there there?
Well, I know the first two guys that was wounded. I can't remember his doctor's name, but he was a tall, slender fellow. And he did, you know, the best he could. These guys are laying in a barn on some straw or swamp hay. And he did what he could.
So did you ever witness any cases of neglect by medical or supply officers?
No, I think they did the best they could with what they had.
What did they have? Did they have adequate supplies?
Well, you see, I can't tell you that. I wasn't in it. I never had to call for a medical corps. We just buried a fellow. He died on the 12th of January, Louis Marietta. He was somehow attached with the medical corps, and then we have another guy by the name of John Percy Clough, who was in the medical corps, and he did a lot of work at Cody's. Now, what I know about this is what I have from hearsay. I was not there.
Was the fighting often continuously severe?
Was it what?
Continuously severe. Did it go on for long stretches of time?
No, it was more often a day or two. Not, you know, it wouldn't go on for a week or so at a time. I guess no one could stand it to go that long. But it'd be renewed every short while.
So, was there any problem with relief troops or anything like that? Would you be up, like if fighting went on for 2 days, did you have to be up for that 2 days?
Once in a while they would send another company up to relieve you, and then you'd go back a little ways, and the first thing you know, you just got settled down, away you go again. We didn't have that many people, you know. There were only 5,500 of us in the beginning, and a good many of those were sick. When I got off the boat at Archangel, or across the bay from there, we had 62 men who had left England. There was only 40 who were able to go on with us out on the fighting line. They stayed at a makeshift hospital that they built in Resnick or back of Ridson. You've heard that name.
Backeries. Yeah.
Farther up the river, we had another up the Dnieper River. That was the other, what did I say before?
Beresnik,
yeah. They had some supplies there. So if you had to come back and get supplies, like food, you'd come back that far.
Was that where the British had their headquarters?
They had a headquarters there. I took a detail back to get some supplies for my platoon. I think I had about six fellas and two sleighs with me. And I carried a few extra Sergeant Sherrins in my pocket. And we got to Bresnik, they had what they call a Sergeant's Club there. The British, they were a little different than they were in the American Army. A sergeant was a pretty big shot in the British Army, more so than a sergeant in the American Army. But they would invite us in. So I, being the only sergeant there, we just pinned a few chevrons on the other guys, and we all went in.
Oh.
And we had lots to drink, sing, and little special eats that they had there. I hope they don't come and arrest me now.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
Really, I think the statute of limitations has run out. Since you didn't have relief troops or break in the fighting or anything, what was the effect on the men's morale, the lack of relief troops, of people to replace you at the front?
Well, I think in a very few instances, some of them, you know, they complained they had frozen feet or something like that. That would get them a trip back to Archangel. But on the whole, they were mighty good guys. They were no slackers. There was no people that you have to have, what is it, amnesty for today? There was nothing like that. They stayed there. They did their job to the best of their ability.
Was your clothing adequate?
Hmm?
Was your clothing adequate?
Yeah, but you wore it for a long, long time.
How common was frostbite?
Hmm?
How common was frostbite?
Quite common. It was cold. However, you had a good hat on, you had a good coat on, you had the heavy underwear, but your face, your nose, could freeze up and you wouldn't even know it. And your fingers. It's kind of hard to handle a gun, you know, if you've got big mittens on. So your hands and face could freeze up. So we would, the Russian women there, they were always glad to help you. Quite often they pour the oil on their lamp into a bowl and they bathe your hands. You put some on your face, you know, and thaw you out, let you hang around the stove for a while. Because they were there, you know, just like we were. When we left, they stayed, most cases.
What was the initial reaction of the peasants to the troops?
Well, there was a difficulty knowing, really knowing, who was your friend and who wasn't. As a rule, the white Russians, so-called, were quite friendly. We could barter with them, we could trade maybe a bully beef or some potatoes, or if you had to find a bottle of liquor someplace, you could almost buy his family for that.
Did the peasants then, did they have definite political convictions about whether they wanted the white Russians or the Bolsheviks to win?
I don't think they wanted either one. They were just satisfied to be left alone, let them eke out their life the way they were. They didn't have anything, so they had nothing to lose.
Did they seem to feel that you were interfering at all, American soldiers or British soldiers?
No, I think they welcomed us, you know, like you would a stranger coming into your house, in most cases.
Did their reaction change during the time that you were there at all?
Oh yes, quite a bit of change. We had several fellows that weren't shot, they were murdered. And that was by the natives, at whatever town you were in. You couldn't be sure, you know, whether he was a Bolo or he was a white Russian, a red or a white. When we would get billeted for the night, if we happened to be in a town, we would put guards, you know, there's only one road, one path going through the town. We put guards at either end, and one night they murdered both ends of the guard of the road.
Were they American guards?
Hmm?
Were they American guards?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Did you ever stay in a Russian family's home?
Yes.
How did they react to you? What were they like?
Well, if you got good friendly with the madam of the house, she liked you, you had a private place to sleep on top of the stove.
Was it the madam and not the mister?
Well, she took care of the house pretty good. As a matter of fact, the women did most everything. The man was pretty soft, I would say. I noticed in the spring when they went out to get the planting going, the plowing and so forth, the man walked along the top of the horse. The woman, she steered the plow. If it got too tough, she'd go up in the pool with the horse. Then the old man would steer the plow, which was easy. Otherwise, he just walked up by his head. You've seen people walk alongside of an elephant. You know, they don't do nothing, they just walk there. Well, that's what the men did with these little Drosky outfits they had.
When you said that the peasants' reaction changed, why do you think it changed? Why did they become hostile enough to kill the American soldiers?
Well, see, I don't know that why they did that. We would assume that they were the red people.
It wasn't
the
really
communists, because they were there all the time.
So the average peasant, though, the one who didn't really care,
they were quite nice.
Yeah, they never changed.
Yeah. They would usually have a four or five in a family. The priests there, they had maybe 10 or 12 because they were the Orthodox Greek, I think, where they marry and have a family.
Were you ever present when the American soldiers had to burn villages?
When they did what?
Sometimes I've read accounts where the American soldiers had orders to burn villages as they retreated.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes.
Were you ever present
yes.
when that happened?
Yes. Helped do it.
Oh.
Gordon Smith, he was, I would say, the best patrol sergeant. And is it working?
Yeah, it's working.
They would use these blockhouses in the woods, you know, and from that they would come out and spy on us, see what we were doing. So it behooved us to get rid of that blockhouse. And Gordon Smith, I'll get got that job 50 times, well, more than that. Say 9 times out of 10, if there was a blockhouse that needed burning, Gordon got that job. That'd be he and himself and a corporal and then 4 or 5 privates. And they would carry cans of kerosene. And they would throw this stuff on, set a match on it, and then they'd run like hell.
What about the peasants' homes? Were they ever burned when you had to burn villages?
Well, when they burned the villages, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, you see, sometimes you had to get rid of them because it made a focal point for the enemy. He could come and use that village for his headquarters. So to keep him from using it, we would have to burn it up.
And what would happen to the peasants?
Well, they just had to find new places to go.
Did they ever react to the Americans, or would you think that that might have affected their attitude towards you, or would they understand why?
I think they understood. I know that first fight we had, there was a hill like this and a hill like this and a wide plateau with some haystacks or straw stacks on it.
Was that Tolkis? Was that Tolkis?
Yeah, going toward Tolkis.
Mm-hmm.
And we made that first attack on Tolkis. And we got down in this plateau. And it was right nice level country. And the natives were coming out of the town over here, Tolkis, with their carts and their horses and dragging everything they could with them. And they kept telling us, Bolshevik, Bolshevik, Bolshevik. We kept right on going anyhow. And they were so anxious when we got up their ways to annihilate us that they started shooting too soon. Had they waited a little longer, they could have killed us all because they were all dug in on the side of the hill. This happened about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we dug holes and laid out there in that field that night till the next afternoon when they managed to get up one Russian gun. So it stayed back on this hill over here and fired over there and knocked them. We could see them getting out of their nest that they had dug in the side of the hill over there and taken off. So then immediately we walked in and we took that town. It didn't burn it or anything, we just took it. It belonged to us then. And we stayed there overnight that night, and then the next day we went on no further. A couple other smaller towns up there. And that was when I was sent out with a patrol to see if we could see anything else, how far they had gone. So we knew they were gone that far after following this river. We knew there was no one there. So I don't know how far they went, because right after that we went back again. I guess somebody figured we were far enough away now from the base, which was, I think, somewhere between, maybe 250 miles.
What were the sanitary conditions like at the front?
There weren't any.
There weren't any. That's what I've heard. What about the house?
If you were lucky, you might find a place where they had come to, you know, the houses over there were in two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
People lived in one, the animals lived in the other one. And usually there was a ramp going up to the upper part of the place where the animals were. So whatever hay they had, they could shove it through down to the animals. And if somebody was, you know, a little ambitious or something, they would make a little square hole in there and a 2x4 around here, and that was your toilet.
Did you serve with any other Allied troops? You mentioned
there were
Canadians.
Not with them. There were others there, mm-hmm, for the same purpose that we were there. But nobody had as many as we had. There was Polish, and like I said about the Italians came up with us. They had one or two boatloads. And I never saw them after we got there. I don't know where they sent them.
But you had Canadians with you, you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. The Canadian artillery.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had, from England, we had some Royal Scots. They worked right with us. They intermingled their line along with our line. The reason for that, I think, was because they weren't dependable. They are guys that had been in France and shot up and were sent back to England to recuperate and were able to do something, so they thought they were going to give them a cushy job and send them up to Archangel. They were worse off than they were in France.
And there were white Russian troops there, too?
Well, they're all white. All the Russians are white.
Well, fighting with you, I mean. Were there White Russian troops that fought with you?
Oh yeah, on our side. Even when we captured the Bolshevik troops, the British tried to make soldiers out of them. That made it worse, tougher for us, because they took it, and then we turned it over to the Russian army, and pretty soon it was lost, and we had to go and do it all over again.
So they weren't very dependable either.
They weren't, no.
How did it make the troops feel, the American troops, that they couldn't depend on their allies?
We got along pretty good with the Scots, but when we got mixed up with the British, the real British troops, it was no good feeling there. I mentioned this over in WCAR the other night, and the guy that was putting on the radio, he's an Englishman.
Why didn't you get along with the British? What was it?
I don't know. They wanted us to think they were superior people. Of course, they had all the officers. Like I've said so many times, if we had a captain on the line and they only had a lieutenant, pretty soon somebody was made a major, which is a step above a captain.
They could be in command. Made a major? A British or an American would be made a major?
The British.
Did you ever feel like you were fighting more for the British than you were for America?
No.
You didn't have...
I don't think the British had near as many troops over there as we had, American troops. You know, if you go and read one of those books, it tells you how they worked on President Wilson to give his permission to send us there. Mm-hmm. And they lied to him. It was supposed that they made him believe this was just a garrison job up there. There wouldn't be no fighting. You're just doing guard duty. That's where we got the notion, I guess, that we're going there to guard rations. No rations to guard.
How did you feel when you were fighting, when your president had just sent you over there not to fight, and then the British made you fight? How did you feel about that?
Well, no, don't say that anybody made us fight. We did fight. This was our orders, and so we did it, wherever the orders came from.
So you don't know where the orders came from. Did you ever?
Well, except they always come from the higher officers.
Yeah,
and they might even come all the way from England, for all we know.
That seems to be the big mystery. What kind of Bolshevik propaganda did you encounter?
They used to put some leaflets out in the woods, and you know, there were a few airplanes in those days, not very many. The natives, they were more afraid. One doctor, he somehow shanghaied an old Ford touring car up there, which he rode, and they would run, you know, like chickens that run away, you know, the natives, when they saw that horseless carriage coming down the road.
But what kind of propaganda would the Bolsheviks try and feed you?
Oh, we should throw down our guns and join them. It's the same stuff they give you today.
Nobody fell for that.
Oh, no. Some of the prisoners that they took of American men, when I came back from Russia, the first man I met in the city of Detroit, they stopped the train. We were on our way to Camp Custer for discharge. And we stepped out, you know, walked out to 4th Street. The first guy I saw was the guy that was captured up there. And he was home 3 months before we were, as a prisoner.
Did you speak to him?
Sure, talked to him. How the hell did you get here? So he gave a little story of how it was. He was captured, and they sent him over to where the railroad is. And they would, there are several others, but it just happened to be, I noticed one man especially. He was in our outfit. Freeman Hogan was his name. Big fella, not too bright. There's quite a few of those in the service. We didn't have to have an A, you know, to enter.
How did he say that they treated
him? He said that when he was on this train along with these other guys, they would go maybe 50 miles. Then he'd make these guys get off the train. They'd march them over, he says, maybe a block away from the train. The train is standing there then. And they would question him. They believe they were going to shoot him right there, then and there. They finally got him down to Petrograd. And from there, they sent him over to Sweden. From Sweden, they got back here to the United States 3 months before we did. That was his story. I had no experience like that myself.
Did the British or your officers ever tell you what would happen if you were captured?
Not in so many words, I don't think. You always had a feeling you didn't want to be captured. At least I always had a feeling that I didn't want to be one of their captures.
Did you change your mind after you talked to that friend?
Well, I was home then.
Yeah, that's true. Did the British employ propaganda at all?
They're the biggest propaganders of all, even in France and all over the world. That's part of war, is propaganda. I guess you have to have it. Look at the propaganda you had in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
What sort of propaganda would the British?
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't be very specific now.
Well, generally.
That'd be hard for me to say.
Okay. How were the Bolshevik prisoners treated when you captured the Bolsheviks?
Not very healthy, especially if they were captured by the Russians, by the Russian part of our army. Mm-hmm. No, they would shoot them rather than take them prisoner.
How about the ones who gave themselves up freely? What happened to them?
Well, they would take and retrain them and put them back supposedly in the White Army. But I don't think that worked too good.
Did you ever witness any atrocities by either the Allies or the Bolsheviks?
Well, it depends on what you want to call an atrocity. I know a Russian officer that was captured, and he was questioned, and when they got all of them, they just tossed him out of the building and shot him. Horizontal execution. I actually saw that once. Now, I don't know how that happened all the time.
Did you ever receive any letters from home mentioning articles in the paper that had occurred about the expedition?
Oh, this is something you're asking me now. I had the job of delivering the mail, and that was sometime just before Christmas. And I had a bag that I passed out to the to whoever we could find at this particular spot. And I myself got 46 letters. That was the first time that I had any mail since we left Camp Custer. Didn't get any mail while I was in England, and until like in the latter part of December 1918.
Did they ever mention anything about how they tried in Congress to bring you home, or anything about the armistice when they were coming home, anything like that?
I don't think there was anything done until long after in 1919, mm-hmm. long after the armistice was signed. And I think our Senator Vandenberg and Senator Johnson, from what I know, probably did more than anyone else. My sister, who lived here in Detroit, she was out running around with petitions to get the boys out of Russia. I suppose many other women were doing the same thing.
Did you know anything about that when you were in Russia?
No.
Was your mail ever censored?
It was my job one time, well, several times I censored the mail that went out. And so while I was doing that, I wrote a letter to one of my teachers that I liked very well, way back in Manistee where I went to school. And she was an eighth grade teacher, very fine gal. So I wrote her a letter, which wasn't censored. And lo and behold, she put a damn thing in the newspaper, the Manistee News Advocate. And that got back to Russia. I got called on the carpet about it. There, I didn't say anything, that was derogatory or giving anything away to the enemy. I just told them the conditions they were living under, which some of the other guys wrote. I wouldn't pass it. I'd cross it out. But I just thought I would tell her. And I never thought she would put it in the paper. But she did.
What happened when you were called on the carpet?
Oh, it just got a little going on, scolding.
You weren't allowed to write out anything about what kind of conditions you were living under or anything?
Even though they were the truth?
Oh, I told what we had to eat and how we had to fix it. What would you do with a handful of rice in a piece of bacon when you have no place to cook it. You gotta wait till some Russian woman will let you in her kitchen and borrow a kettle from her. I remember one time we pooled our rice. I borrowed a kettle and a stove from the, you know, they have these mammoth stoves, which once they build a fire in it, it's hot for 24 hours. So we pooled our rice, and I got a big crock for, you know, and I put this in the oven, and it began to cook, you know, and it just kept coming like this. So it's never going to stop. That was some of the funny things that happened, too. And another thing, they used to send us potatoes, like potato chips today, but they were dipped in paraffin. So you could eat one or two, you know, not too bad, but if you wouldn't like lieutenant, he was going to be the cook one day. He said, I'm going to give you guys some scallop potatoes. So they gathered up these paraffin chips, you know. He did the same thing I did, put them in the oven, and he's fixing them up. They've got some vegetables someplace. And then when he got done, they were just like glue. The paraffin all melted and everything was sticky, you know.
Would you say that you were received enough food? Was it adequate for the physical work labor that you had to do?
Well, it's what the Army gave us. We used to get some beef once in a while. It came in a can about this round. There were some vegetables, and we call it M&D, or they call it. That's the name of it. I don't know where it came from, some packing house. And when you first ate it, you know, for a little while, it was pretty good, you know, like some stew you might buy in a grocery store. It never tastes like what your mother made for you. Mm-hmm. But it would get pretty tiresome, you know, after you had a few, and once in a while, a can of corned beef and the hardtack. And then we could get some Russian bread occasionally, which every time I ate it, I had diarrhea for a week.
But you were fairly well fed anyway.
Oh, yeah, nobody starved, but it wasn't anything you would want.
Did you ever know any cases of malnutrition or food poisoning?
No, I don't think so.
And about there or at any time?
We all had ample of what there was, like I say about the rice and peas. Now, you couldn't eat them, you couldn't throw them in your mouth. Well, I suppose you could if you're hungry enough. You could chew on them, maybe. But I never got that bad off.
Did you ever have any dealings with the Red Cross or the YMCA?
And the Red Cross, they caught up to us, I think, a day or two before we left Russia. The YMCA had some huts around various places. When you were going forward or coming back, you might run into one. You could get a cup of cocoa or buy some cigarettes, and they never gave us any. At least I never was lucky to have any given to them. But they would give you a cup of cocoa sometimes, and you really needed it.
Did you have any money to buy anything from them at that time?
Well, we didn't get paid over there all the time we were there. And money was no good anyway. You could barter for something, you know. Like once in a while you got a piece of candy somehow from somebody back here would send you a package, it might be a piece of candy. You could do a lot with that.
When it came to buying something from the YMCA, like cigarettes, how would you do that then?
At that time, they were 50 cents a package, and I think there was only 10 cigarettes in a package at that time. They did issue cigarettes once in a while, Ruby Queens, and that was made in England. It was English made anyway. And they came 10 in a package. That was once in a while issued to us. We didn't have to buy that.
So you could buy cigarettes. Did you have the money?
In the YMCA.
Yeah.
Well, you finally got money somehow from the Russians. I brought back quite a bit of coins and a few bills.
Okay.
Well, they call money is ruble.
How about the Salvation Army?
We didn't see much of the Salvation Army. They were very good in France, though. Mm-hmm. And the Red Cross, they came and dished out some peaches and some pet milk or milk of that kind. And the guy says to me, what the hell am I going to do with this? I said, did you ever hear of peaches and cream? I said, open that can, pour it in your biscuit, put the condensed milk on, you got peaches and cream.
How did you spend holidays? Like Thanksgiving and Christmas?
Well, I remember Christmas. very distinctly, we were given some plum pudding. That was a special ration that one day.
Did you like it?
I never cared for British. It was British make, and I never cared very much for British food. We got enough of that over in Camp Calshot. We ate mutton every day.
Do you remember anything special at all about holidays besides the plum pudding? Was there anything else special they did for you besides a little special dinner?
Well, for Christmas dinner, like I say, we had this plum pudding.
Well,
that was quite a special.
Yeah.
Pretty good portion of it.
When did you leave Tulgas?
Oh, I can't tell you a specific date. I'd have to get a diary for that.
Do you have a diary?
I started one, and when we got so near being captured, I just left all of the junk there.
When was that?
Oh, that was back in about March of 1919. Mm-hmm. We were on the retreat then.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times you had to get out with very short notice.
What do you remember from that? Anything? Do you remember anything particular about that retreat?
Yeah, I remember a lot about the retreat from Shenkhurst.
Oh.
And we also retreated from another when we were with this Russian captain, just that small detachment. We retreated from there one night. We got the word the Bolos were coming. And we didn't let the natives that we were living with at all. We just got a window open. We went out the window. Didn't wake them or make any noise, as quiet as we could, and got out of there. Got everybody out on the way back north. North is going toward home, you know.
Yeah.
And so when they came the next day looking for us, we weren't there. They did the same thing to us a couple of times, too. We were looking for them. We got there, they weren't there.
Could you hear them shouting in the distance then as you were retreating?
We could hear the big cannons. You know, I had a unique experience. Before the war, I was a machinist, and I went to work at the American Car and Foundry, where they used to make cars for the railroad. And I worked on machines over there that used to turn axles for the big railroad cars, and we converted them to shell machines to turn 11-inch shells. That's a shell about that big and that long. And they were making them for the Russian government at that time. This was before we were in the war. But they were making these supplies for Russia. Then you get over there and they're shooting them back at you. And I used to know from the, where you would see the flash and the sound, you know how far away they were. Now, I can't remember what that arithmetic was. But the flash is instant, and then comes the sound. And when it explodes by you, then you could tell how far away they were by computing the flash to the sound,
sort of like
or the explosion, rather.
Yeah.
When you could really hear them whistling, they were about halfway.
What I'd like you to tell me about is when your platoon disappeared for 5 weeks with Lieutenant Wallace.
Wallace was our lieutenant, and Captain Metchievsky was in command of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the officers we had, except for non-coms. That's non-commissioned officers.
Yeah. When was that you were gone for 5 weeks and nobody...
That would be in the month of November. Well, on our first skirmish there, we were in a village called Shredmacringen. And we had quite a fight there. It happened on a Sunday. And when that was over, we went a little further south to a place called Gora. Then we went from there. We didn't find any enemy in Gora. But we went about 15 miles further. There was another little village, which I don't recall the name. And we walked through the woods all night and came and attacked their meat from the rear. And we captured all the supplies they had. We didn't capture many people, but we captured all their supplies. I think there was 15 wagons of stuff we had, you know, supplies of one kind or another. And by this time we were as lousy as could be, and finally got back to Soletsko, I believe, was the next place, was our next stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we stayed there about a week. Had all real soft for a week. F Company was there, and we just billeted it right in with them. When did machine gun school? So that was one time when we had a week's rest, and that's about the only time I can think of where we had more than a day at a time.
Oh. Do you remember?
The retreat from Shankers,
yeah.
Shankers, that was quite a thing. Now, they had an outpost probably 15 miles further out than Shankers was, where they had set up to guard Shankers.
Shagavari?
What's
it called?
No, Shagavari is the other way, north of it.
I see.
So they finally had to make up their minds they had to get out of there. So they did all the firing they could. They had some Canadians there too, and they did all the firing they could. And suddenly they left as fast as they could. So they were coming in route step, and we were sent up to meet them, my particular company. And we met them at Shagavari. From there we did the rear guard.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Vistovka, which was probably another 50 miles or more. Then we stopped there, and we had been there before, and we had some fortifications. So we immediately used this and held that place for a week. We were totally surrounded until another company came from the up to help us out there. And we had a lieutenant, it was the 4th platoon that came up to help us. We had a Lieutenant Ray Durham, who at one time was a senator in Lansing. And in World War II, he was a colonel in the intelligence division.
Mm-hmm.
And he died. His head was all gone. Was real, real crazy, insane. He came from the upper peninsula. But a wonderful, wonderful guy, a real soldier. The guy could, he was a pretty good sized man. He'd pick up a machine gun, a Lewis machine gun, up to his shoulder and shoot it like a rifle. There weren't too many that could do that. They'd lie down, you know, on a tripod.
That's what I was thinking.
Did you have any contact with the other battle fronts while you were there?
We were called the River Front,
mm-hmm.
and we spent most of our time on the various rivers there.
I mean, like, in terms of knowing where the other companies were. When you were at
Well, you always could guess pretty near. Now, we finally got to both sides of the Dvina River. That river is a mile wide in some places.
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, you could, you know, haul anything you had across it. You could haul a cannon across it. And so we also did some fighting on the far side of the Dvina River. But that all came long after the armistice. See, like we say, the woods are full of them now. That second fight in Tolgast, when they attacked us, we were hanging them in a barbed wire, and they still kept coming. We had time, you know, to build up some barbed wire entanglements, and they either had to cut it, you couldn't take time to cut it, so they were trying to jump over and things like that, and they were tangled in there, and that's where we laid them out there. And the other gang, that's the same place where the Canadians reversed their
yeah.
guns there.
Okay, when you were at Shagavari and...
Well, those guys that had been in Shankers, they just
yeah.
went on ahead. So we stayed behind to keep the enemy back so they couldn't re-attack again. This is like shoot and run, you know. Not that fast, but you'd be laying there maybe for 2 or 3 hours firing at the advancing Bolsheviks. And we would get up and go as good as we could, you know.
What was the condition of Company A, the troop that was retreating from Shankar?
They were well shot up before they got out of it. That company probably had more casualties than any other company.
Okay. Since you were on the front and you were witness, you know, you were the ones who were going through all the hardships and the real perils of the war, how did you feel about the officers who remained in Archangel? Did you feel bitter about that at all?
Well, there had to be some officers there.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Well, how could you feel bad about it? That was their job. That was their part of the army. Oh, sometimes they would send an officer that was up on the front back and take one of those guys there and send him up in his place, same as they did with some of the enlisted men, or the conscripted men, as you better say. Some of them were enlisted. I had a good friend there, his name was A.D. Cox. He enlisted in Texas and came to Camp Custer. He was a sergeant. Albert Dane Cox.
Oh, I should turn it back to zero, shouldn't I? Right? No, put the numbers back to zero. Okay.
Okay, you were talking about the retreat from Shenkhurst and being rear guard?
Yeah. We were leaving Shagabari now. Heading north.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to Vistavka, a little town there where we stopped and held the Bolsheviks back there. We stayed there for a week, and I told you about Ray Durham coming up there with his rifle. There was a ravine there. And when they came up, he spotted this ravine, and the Bolos were coming down there. They had shelled that thing the day before. Oh, tremendously. They just obliterated the blockhouse that was there. And he stood up there on that hill, and these guys were coming in the ravine, and they came, and they came. And he kept mowing them down, he and another guy standing up there with their Lewis guns. Didn't take much infantry when those two guys were firing it as fast as they could go, you know. They had bandoliers. Well, they're about that big around, you know, that attached the gun. I don't know how many shells there are. There probably 100 or more. And here they were in this hollow. They couldn't run up the hill because we were on the other side of them. But as long as they were in that ravine, it was his job to knock them off, which he did. And after that, we kept slowly going toward the Arctic Ocean again, back toward Archangel.
When did you arrive in Archangel? About what month?
Well, I think the early part of June,
mm-hmm.
possibly the latter part of May. And we didn't go to Archangel. We went to some place just north of Archangel. I know we were. We lived in tents there because it was June weather. And one of the early days in June, maybe along about the 10th, they had a big snowstorm.
Wow.
Okay. Before you were saying that when you first encountered the Bolsheviks that they were badly disciplined and they didn't know how to fight and that you could outfight them very easily. Did that change at all towards the end of your stay there?
Oh yes, tremendously, because you got all those trained troops that were relieved from doing the fighting in East Germany.
Uh-huh.
The Eastern Front was no more. So when they made their separate peace, that's when we really got into trouble. We weren't fighting kids or, you know, guys that didn't know much then. They were real soldiers with real equipment and everything.
So, Were you at Vistavska or Maximovskaya fighting there? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember how the Bolsheviks fought at all or anything about that battle?
That would have been in March. 19.
Yeah, that would have been about March.
Well, I think in March was when we were surrounded. I was just telling you about that, how we stopped. That's the retreat from Shenkhurst.
When
now,
the other company
there were other
rescued
fellas,
you?
Like over at Paniga or Oniga, which they might know the same things I know, but not the same story. It's the same kind of a battle all the way around, you know. The guys on the railroad, they were entirely different kind of a war than we had. They rode up back and forth in boxcars or some kind of cars, transportation. They had cannons loaded on flat cars. So their war was a little different from us guys who were over on the river. The Bolsheviks had gunboats on the river that could fire at us all the time, and they could outshoot the Canadian field artillery that was with us.
Okay.
They could be three times as far away and hit us, you know, as they could with their 3-inch guns that they had.
That sounds like it would be a serious disadvantage.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah. What were your first impressions of Archangel when you got there finally?
Just an
I didn't see it.
Oh, you didn't see it.
I never was in there.
Economy?
All I know, what I could see from the boat as it went by.
Oh, really? You just stopped at Bacarita and then
that's
up?
Right.
Okay.
We just passed Archangel and we went right across the river, or across the bay there, where this Bacarita was already there, and they had that converted into some kind of a hospital where all the guys that were sick unloaded there. Then I presume when we were gone up the river, maybe they transferred them over to Archangel. I don't know that they did or not.
Okay. When did you first discover that you were going to go home?
Well, I guess when we got back there north of Archangel. We had communication that we had seen where the Bolsheviks were going to drive us into the Arctic Ocean.
Uh-huh.
So fortunately, they had some boats there waiting for us. And we saw the boats as we came down there, so we knew something like that was going to happen.
You didn't know until you got to Archangel, though?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you feel like you hadn't finished what you were sent there to do at all? Or were you just glad to be going home?
I believe we all felt like that because we all felt we had no business being there in the first place.
Uh-huh.
I don't think anyone knows today purely, truly why we were there. Some Britisher's pipe dream. Mm-hmm. Although the thing about this establishing a submarine base up there in the North Atlantic probably had some merit to it, but the war had ended.
Mm-hmm.
Even before anything like that was started, it was just, you know, talk or paperwork or whatever.
So the whole time you were there, you felt like you had no business being there, especially after the
That's right. We had, we felt more we were fighting for self-preservation, certainly after Christmas.
Uh-huh. Okay. When you returned to the States, what kind of reception did you receive?
We hardly received none, but there were. Half of the outfit came back 2 weeks before we did, and I guess they had a royal reception here in the city of Detroit. They were, I think, dined, and they marched around Belle Isle and up Woodward Avenue and had a good time here in the city. But when we came, we went right on. So we just stopped a half an hour down at the old Union Depot.
Got in too late, huh?
We had a few days in Boston, because when we came back, we landed at Boston Camp Devens. So Art Gallagher and I, we got took off, went down to visit Boston. We saw Bunker Hill and a few things over there.
Oh.
We went looking for strawberry shortcake. But we were too late. There was no strawberries left.
Oh, boy. How come you stayed there longer than the other troops?
Well, I don't know.
You just didn't get back to Archangel in time to leave with them or what?
We left Russia pretty much all together.
Oh, really?
You know, they wouldn't send you all out together just like going over there. We were miles apart, but there was 13 boats going to cross the Atlantic when we left here. And we had battleships and submarines, and you'd see them every once in a while and run around. Guards supposed to be guarding us, you know.
So did you arrive at France about the same time? Camp Brest?
We landed at Liverpool.
You didn't go to France after Russia?
The rest of them, not everybody from the 85th Division went to Liverpool.
Oh.
I don't know exactly where they went. They went, maybe landed at the Brest and then scattered out someplace in France.
Oh, so you just went to Liverpool, huh? Okay, after you got back, did many people around know exactly about the expedition? Or did a lot of people just kind of wonder where you've been all this time or what?
Oh, I think at that time our war was probably looked upon as though nothing had happened, rather than what went through France and all that. You know, that had been going on for 4 or 5 years. And when we entered the war, I guess we declared war in 1916, I think. And we didn't get started until 1917. The first contingent that went over to Camp Custer for training was in August, because I went over there in September and I was 2 weeks late.
So what did people think when you got back? What did they think you'd
be doing? I can't remember that anybody thought anything special.
Mm.
I went back up home and had a good vacation up in Manistee, up on the shores of Lake Michigan. until September. The first September, I came back to Detroit. And I was walking along Woodward Avenue one afternoon, and I met a fellow who I had worked with before I went to service. He was a foreman at the it's strange you can forget a name that's 60 years old.
Was it the automobile plant?
It was a plant where they started making the first airplanes were made right next door to them. That plant was turned into an airplane plant that moved over to Willow Run before they started the airplane. Of course, this had nothing to do with the war. This was during mm-hmm. peacetime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Harry Jameson was running this plant. I don't remember that name. Anyway, they sold out to the Hudson Motor Car. So that plant was moved out to the Hudson plant. Clayton Lambert. Mm-hmm. That's who that was. And I worked there previous to going into service. In between, I worked at American Car and Foundry, making these bullet machines too, shell machines. And he said, we visited and talked for a while, you know, they wanted to know a little about the war and so forth. He said, I got a shop of my own now. He and two other guys had started a shop that same month. And we happened to be right near Sullivan and Woodward. And he says, just around the corner there, they had started a little place above a garage on Sullivan, about two or three doors from Woodward. So he's come over and see us sometime. So I did, about 3 or 4 days later. He says, well, you want to go to work? He says, we need some help. So I was their first employee. And that place today is known as Star Tool and Die Works, which probably is worth somewhere around 18, 20 million.
Anyway, what was his reaction when you told him about what you'd done in Russia? Was he ignorant of what had been going on?
Oh, no.
No, he knew.
Anybody who was in machine business would know something about the war because they had to make all the material for it, practically.
That's true.
Clayton Lamberts were making, when I worked there, they were making the nose piece that they put in the front of those big shells, a timer. You know, the shell goes so far, and then there's a mechanism in there that makes it explode at a certain distance out. This shrapnel, you know, it's that thick. And there's that powdered explosives inside. And this little timer was made out of brass that they made at Clayton Lambert's.
Hmm.
It's sitting in the head, and that's set for how far they want to fire that shell. Then it explodes. That's shrapnel. It can come out chunks that maybe weigh 10 ounces, and some maybe weigh a pound.
Was the average soldier recognized for his bravery by the higher command?
There were some medals given out, and in some occasions given to the wrong person.
Yeah.
I guess that happens quite often. I know a couple of lieutenants got medals where it should have been a sergeant who was with them should have had the medals. Yeah, I knew Captain Ojard. He was the guy that worked for Detroit Edison before the war. And he got a medal from, it was the medal that the Tsar used to give out. Mm-hmm. Somehow or other, how they did it when we were there, the Tsar was already gone. But he has a beautiful medal that the Tsar used to give out. And he died in 1972, and the lady was his housekeeper. She's wearing it. Beautiful thing.
Looking back, what I suppose you've already answered what the purpose you felt the purpose was about the submarines and to guard the war supplies. And since in practice you were under the British command and you were doing different things, did that affect your feeling towards the British at all?
I think that created more bad feeling than probably anything else did. We even wore British clothes when our American clothes wore out. You had maybe a pants or a jacket, one or the other something else, you know. Did anybody ever tell you about the shackles and boots? Never heard about them.
I've heard that they were slippery.
Yeah, you did hear. Well, some guy by the name of Shackleton was a discoverer. He's an explorer. in Alaska, and he developed these boots to wear. They were nice and warm, supposed to be, you know. And so they sent them to us, and we gave up our hobnails, shoes, and we were supposed to wear these boots, which he just couldn't wear. Might have been all right for some guys exploring, you know, he could do what he wanted to, or whatever he wanted to, or what. But we couldn't fight with those things on our feet. Then they even sent us snowshoes one time. We had to learn to walk on snowshoes. And that petered out in a hurry. That went faster than the Shackleton boots.
So what did you end up wearing?
The old hobnails.
That you got these back.
Sure. Same kind of stuff we wore over at Camp Custer. They were a little cold, but at least you could stand up with them. You know, it was like wearing, they were about that long and as slippery as could be in the snow. That Shackleton boot. It was a nice warm shoe.
Just not practical.
The Russians had the right thing. They wore felt boots up to here.
Uh-huh.
Thick felt. Now, where in the world they got them, I don't know, but they would be half to three quarters of an inch thick. No shoes, just those felt boots.
Would you say that your experience in North Russia affected your outlook on life?
Well, I guess if you didn't appreciate this country then, before that, you certainly would after you'd been there. Because, now I have to say again that we didn't live in the good part of Russia. We lived with the peasants who were mostly not very well educated, probably couldn't read or write, most of them. I know older people, I would ask them sometimes what their age was, you know, and they'd give you some terrific figure, and they'd ask him again. He wouldn't tell you the same thing every time. He's so old, he's something anyway. And the kids the same way. I never saw a schoolhouse then. And then again, they didn't measure a town by the number of people like you do here. They measured it by the number of buildings that were there. How many houses, how many homes. So one home might have three or four kids, another one might have a half dozen, right? And the women weren't dressed at all like you see women here today. I never saw anyone in this country dressed like they were. Their skirt was just a piece wrapped around them and tied around the waist. The men wore fur coats, but it was a bear skin. The front legs were the sleeves, and it slipped down the belly and buttoned up. But we saw other guys that somehow or other came up from Petrograd or Moscow who were well-dressed. Nice, chinchilla coats and things like that, fur-lined. See, once in a while you'd see some person, even a woman or two that maybe somehow in their younger days got away and got down there and come back for a visit or something like that. And then they were well-dressed, nice dressed. I guess in the cities they probably weren't too bad off. But out where we were, you know, out in the woods, they could make a clearing of, I don't know how many acres, maybe 15, 20 acres or more, and they had four or five houses. Out around the houses they would do their farming, right up to the edge of the woods. They'd have a head man of the village. He was called the starister, and he would set a day when they would start plowing, the day when they'd sow their seeds, the day they would harvest. And they raised like onions and flax and rye, potatoes, a little bit of potatoes, not too many. And then he would take this in the fall to Archangel or some other town. There were other towns there, you know, but Archangel was the real city. And he would barter this stuff off and bring it back and then pass it out to the people, whatever they needed.
How was the communications with the peasants?
How what?
How did you communicate with the peasants?
Well, we had interpreters. Polish people could learn the Russian quite easily. And I could do it pretty good too with my Danish. I could read and write Danish, speak it too. I still can. And they have lots of words, they don't mean the same thing, but you might pronounce them the same, and then you find out, well, that means so and so. And they, actually, we learned their language much quicker than they could learn ours.
Thank you.
I imagine that you were
for eating and eggs and potatoes and things like that. You would know the each individual, so you could make some signs. And Katoski is a potato, you know. What did they call an egg? I don't remember what an egg was, but I know it cost 50 cents, 5 rubles, and a ruble was worth a dime in those days. 5 rubles for one egg.
Wow, that sounds like a lot.
Don't pay that today.
How do you feel about the whole expedition being shrouded in mystery, and that you just went out and fought and you weren't told why? How did that make you feel?
Well, it was my first experience in a war, so I guess I suppose that's the way it goes. I presume the same feeling the guy had who went to France, although you knew all about France before our men went to France.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know anything about Russia when we went there.
I think I would wonder why I was fighting the person I was fighting.
Well, look, we weren't very old. We were maybe had a few oats to sow yet, and that's part of it.
Did you feel any bitterness about it afterwards at all?
Do I feel any better about it afterwards?
Bitterness or...
Bitterness?
Yeah.
Oh, I always say it's a nice experience to have had, but I wouldn't want to do it over again. Not for the same reasons, or in the same way. I have to believe that some of those people are still living, like they did when we were there. No kinds of plumbing of any kind. They had wells to get water out of. And we weren't allowed to drink the water until somebody from the medical corps came and dumped the chlorine in it. Then it turned red when they put that in it. Then you were allowed to drink it. But on the other hand, the Russians all wore caps, hard caps, something like what the policemen wear.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're going through the woods, there's swamps all over. They just dip that cap down in the swamp and take a drink. They didn't die.
Probably immune. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Something that we've forgotten to question you about?
I don't know. I think you did a pretty good job.
Ran you over the coals, huh?
Oh, at one time you didn't ask about when you get staying steady in a place for a short time. You keep sending out patrols. We send out a patrol. They send out a patrol. Finally, you get to where you begin to meet their patrol. We meet in the woods someplace, and you get to be not enemies, but kind of friends. So we had a, north of Tongass there, we had a thing like that going over there.
The Bolsheviks and you?
Yeah, yeah. We wouldn't just actually see them, but they'd put things in a tree, like a mailbox out there in the woods. And we would exchange our notices. They say, you join us, and then we'd tell them, well, they come and join us, so we wouldn't have to fight. And at Christmas time, they put a note in that they wouldn't bother us, they wouldn't fight us on our Christmas if we would leave them alone on their Christmas. And they held their word, but not us. We had to go and bother them on Christmas. Just go up to the line where they were stationed, shoot. Maybe try to burn a blockhouse.
How did that make you feel?
Not good.
No.
We didn't really do any good. But when you're told to do something in the army, you would do it, or something else happens to you.
Where would those orders come from? Your major and
officer? Oh, no, this is just the privates that did that. Oh, no, the officers weren't supposed to know what was going on there. Some of them did.
No, I mean when you were told to go bother them on their Christmas.
Well, we didn't feel good about it, but we had to do it.
Because the officers told you to?
Sure. It wasn't our idea.
Yeah.
We didn't want to go at any time anyway. That's a dirty job. Lots of guys got shot up going on patrol. They could hide in the woods and stand behind a tree and they could see you and you don't know they're there. And wham, first thing you know, you had lost a guy.
Did you ever talk to the Bolsheviks?
Not out on the firing line.
Well,
some of these guys were taken prisoner, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, as much as an American and a Russian can talk, it wouldn't be too much. But the British, they were usually the interpreters. You see, they outranked us in everything, everywhere.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't like it. Nobody else liked it. They don't like it today, even. I answered that question before.
That's right. I remember.
But, so when you talked...
I couldn't say that I really hated them. But I would just soon been with my own people all the time. They could be where they were and we could be where we were. The Royal Scots weren't that bad, but they were... I felt sorry for those guys. They shouldn't have been there at all. I think when they sent them out of England, they thought they were going someplace for a rest.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they were the most cooties guys, if you know what cooties are. They crawl around in your clothes.
Yeah.
More if you take your clothes off, they don't bother you. And these guys, if they claimed that you'd see them sitting sometime that night, they're looking at their shirt and the cooties are going here and there. They get off your body and stay on the clothes. And he said, I'm training this skag here. Scotchman says, you know, sitting there watching and tell him, give them commands like you do the soldiers. So they have a little sense of humor too.
Mm-hmm.
Is that thing still going?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. You had quite a lot to tell us, and it was just great.
Well, it should have come around 50 years ago. I could have told you.